Now all is high activity in Freud's London household as arrivals of many sorts take place in our last reading from The Death of Sigmund Freud by Mark Edmondson. The reader is Anton Lesser.
The 30th of September, the date that the Munich Accord was signed, though dated the 29th, was a good day for Sigmund Freud. It was the day he moved into the house that would be associated with his memory, 20 Maresfield Gardens in London.
"Far too beautiful for us," Freud said of his new address.
One of the reasons he was eager to sell an American edition of the Moses book was to help pay his considerable mortgage. The house had 8 bedrooms, 3 bathrooms, and 2 garages. There were gardens at the front and back, as well as a lawn for playing tennis. Freud declared that he was going from poverty to white bread in a stroke. Ernst, his architect's son, had the wall knocked out between 2 rooms downstairs, so as to give Freud a large area that would serve as study and consulting room. This was a sun-brightened space, unlike Freud's darker precincts at Berggasse 19, and here he would be able to sit at his desk as the light poured in. But there was still the matter of Freud's furniture. His books, his antiquities, his paintings, his carpets, all the things that had made his Vienna sanctum what it was. Freud, sceptical of all human endeavours, wasn't sure the Nazis would release his property. Then, in the first week of August, Freud's shipment arrived, and moving into Maresfield Gardens, he could begin to restore his old life. Here was his library, or at least the balance of it. Here was the famous couch, a gift from an early patient, a Mrs. Benvenisti, who presented him with it in 1891. And, most warming to Freud, his collection of antiquities, fully intact. In the middle of it all sat Freud like a monarch whose kingdom had late in life been restored to him. He received a great number of visitors at Maresfield Gardens. One of the more intriguing was from Leonard and Virginia Woolf. Leonard was the director of the Hogarth Press, which had been publishing Freud's books in English translation. "It was not an easy interview," Leonard recalls in his memoir. "Freud was extraordinarily courteous, in a formal, old-fashioned way. For instance, almost ceremoniously, he presented Virginia with a flower." The flower was a narcissus, a strange enough gift given Freud's ideas about the female proclivity for narcissism and Wolf's repudiation of such thoughts. To her, men were by far the greater practitioners of self-love. "There was something about him," Leonard continues, "as of a half-extinct volcano, something sombre, suppressed, reserved. He gave me the feeling of great gentleness, but behind the gentleness, great strength." They sat down for tea in Freud's consulting room, which seemed to Leonard almost a museum. And they talked, naturally, about Hitler. Leonard, not always the most tactful of men, went on to tell Freud a story. He described a recent court case in which a man was convicted of stealing a number of books from foils, including a volume of Freud's. The magistrate who heard the case fined the man, then expressed another punishment. He wanted to sentence the man to the reading of all of Freud's work. Freud was amused, so Leonard claims, and self-deprecatory about his own achievements.
"My books have made me infamous, not famous."
Virginia Woolf's account of the afternoon is rather different to Leonard's. She recalled Freud as
a screwed-up, shrunk, very old man with monkey's light eyes, paralysed, spasmodic movements, inarticulate, but alert.
Later she added,
"All refugees are like gulls with their beaks out for possible crumbs."
Anna Freud was developing a book. Martin hoped to place a novel, and they made the error of asking Virginia for advice.
Surely the most surprising figure to pass through Freud's London life was Dr. Anton Sauerwald, the Nazi commissioner who handled his case in Vienna and who turned up in London in October 1938. His name is inscribed in Freud's diary. It was clear to the family that Sauerwald had saved Freud from serious trouble by holding back information about his finances, and particularly his overseas accounts, from the Nazis. After the war, when Sauerwald went on trial for war crimes, Anna Freud and Marie Bonaparte wrote letters on his behalf, entreating the court for mercy, which was granted. Perhaps Sauerwald did admire Freud. Perhaps he did take an interest in psychoanalysis. But nothing that the commissioner did should escape assumption that some duplicity was involved. Amidst all the adulation, there was one discordant note. Freud received endless advice not to publish the Moses book. On May the 17th, the deed was done. The most scandalous parts of Moses and monotheism were his reflections on the identity of Moses. Moses was not a Jew, but an Egyptian. The Egyptians were the first to disseminate the idea of there being one God and one only. The chosen people, angry because of what Moses had asked them to relinquish, murdered their greatest prophet and lapsed back into their old forms of polytheism. They felt remorse for what they had done, and that remorse exalted Moses' memory. The slain Moses became Judaism's great man, and the old Mosaic god Aton became accordingly the precursor for Yahweh. Freud was letting his mind roam. He was speculating. Reviews and early responses to the book were as furious and uncomprehending as Freud anticipated. To Abraham Yehuda, that thoughtful neighbour on Ellsworthy Road, the book might have been the work of a Christian fanatic out to malign the Jews. Father McNab, writing for the Catholic Herald, wondered how long free England would extend a welcome to the author of so scandalous a book. Freud's response was characteristic. He revelled in the book's sales figures. Old and in pain from the cancer which had returned, he still had the stuff for a fight.
"Quite a worthy exit," he said of the Moses book,
which was true enough. On May the 6th, 1939, Freud celebrated his 83rd birthday. He sat for a while in the garden and received birthday greetings from family and friends, which were, as per family tradition, tied around the necks of the household dogs and sent Freud's way. The great problem for Freud was Lun, his chow, who had been released from quarantine after the mandatory 6 months. The dog had always adored her master. Freud had petted her, walked her, and frequently talked with her. She seemed to him the sanest presence in his life. But now she cowered on the far side of the sick room as a smell of decomposition came from her master.
Freud knew what this meant, Max Schur, his doctor, says, and looked at his pet with a tragic and knowing sadness.
On September the 1st, a day when Freud lay in his study doing what he could to control the pain in his jaw, Nazi troops burst across the border into Poland. 2 days later, both France and England declared war, and the conflagration began. During Freud's lifetime, the world had propelled itself into 2 world wars, 2 great upsurges of destruction. This was for many reasons, Freud suggests in his essay, Why War? But mainly because for the great majority of people,
It's simply too hard to live with the anxiety and satisfactions that peace can bring. In his later work, Freud speaks of something called the death drive, by which he means the drive of an organism, human or animal, complex or one-celled, to seek its own destruction. The death drive, Freud indicates, is the direct result of too much acquiescence to the demands of civilization. It is the result of tensions and an inability to find pleasure or rewarding work in peaceful times. Arrayed against death is the power that Freud called Eros, the force that draws human beings together in large, civilized and civilizing groups. Yet, as Freud understood it, humanity can turn against Eros, turn against love's pleasures, and affirm death exclusively. Schur sat at Freud's bedside, who told him to
talk it over with Anna, and if she thinks it right, make an end of it.
Schur spoke to Anna, and Anna concurred with her father's wish. That same day, September the 21st, Schur gave Freud an injection of 3 grams of morphine, a dose much stronger than he would have used to relieve pain. Schur was assisting in a suicide. At midnight on the 22nd, Sigmund Freud was still alive. The next day was Yom Kippur, the Jewish Day of Atonement, and in the morning many Jews in London would be making their ways to synagogue, entreating the God, whom Sigmund Freud had done all he could to discredit, for forgiveness. All through the capital there were sandbags in place ready for the air raids. Statues were being removed or enclosed in brick for protection. Soon Eros would be gone from Piccadilly Circus. Eros's antagonist in Freud's mythology, the force he called death, was ready to ascend. At 3 in the morning, on Saturday, September the 23rd, 1939, Sigmund Freud died from cancer and from Schur's morphine overdoses. Freud particularly relished a story that goes something like this. An atheist, who has sold insurance for a living, lies on his deathbed. There comes to visit him, in his hour of need, a minister determined to save the man's soul. The minister spends 2 hours, then 3, sitting with the man grappling with Satan, or whatever force it is that stands between salvation and the wayward salesman. When the minister finally leaves the sick room, all of the man's friends crowd around. Is he saved? Is his soul pure? No, the minister has to admit, all of his entreaties failed. But the minister is happy to announce he's now the owner of a fine new insurance policy, acquired at a splendid discount.
Anton Lesser reading The Death of Sigmund Freud by Mark Edmondson. It was abridged for radio by Penny Lester and produced by Duncan Minshall. Next week's biography is John Carey's history of the life and career of the publicity-shy Nobel Prize-winning author William Golding, the man who wrote Lord of the Flies. That's our reading next week at the same time from Monday.
People do find it curious that a chap of my age likes the things that I like. But I do honestly feel that it's one of those situations where everyone's out of step except our John.
This weekend on 4 Extra, Jarvis Cocker looks back over the extraordinary career of a true musical maverick.
There's so many records, I'm surprised that the house hasn't kind of sunk.
The footings are reinforced.
Right.
With classic on-air appearances and the record collection that shaped the taste of a nation.
A lot of the bands that we played then, people like the Pink Floyd and so forth and Jimi Hendrix, people at the time said, how can you possibly play this awful stuff?
Acres, John Peel Remembered, tomorrow morning at 9 and again in the evening at 7.